But okay, thank you everyone for coming to the journal club today. We'll have four papers to discuss. So the first one is from JTO. It's about the molecular subtyping of pulmonary carcinoid. So I think the idea is that now we are there's an interest in subgrouping like small cell carcinoma with all those four markers that we are aware of. So there are different groups. They want to do the kind of similar thing, use like RNA expression and or protein expression to subgroup pulmonary carcinoid. So this is a Netherlands group that proposed the subgrouping of this pulmonary carcinoid to see if they have treatment effect or prognosis effect. So the concept from two papers, one of them is from Memorial Sloan Kettering. We know they proposed the small cell classification. They kind of use the same idea, looking at RNA expression profile in a previous paper to subclassify pulmonary carcinoid into three groups. So regarding its typical or atypical carcinoid, but just like using expression of OTP, ACL1 and HNF1A to subclassify into A1, A2, and B. And the same Netherlands group, one of the senior author also have another paper that there to talk about the same idea. So that this paper is kind of follow up the concept of the clustering. The markers they use are OTP, ACL1, HNF1A. Click on the team. And there's other prognostic markers, CD44, OTP, ACL1, and Ki-67. We and Heather talked about that last week in a different paper. There are other markers other people use for further subgrouping. We'll be discussing this as a paper as well. They also look at other two markers for potential targeted treatment. So the aim is to establish an IHC marker panel for subclassification. The method is, so they look at back their tissue registry to find those resected pulmonary carcinoids. They only get the resection specimen. And among those, they found or they pick five per each group from the previous study. They had the RNA sequencing data. They pick five cases from each subgroup, the A1, N2, and B from the previous study. They have overlap cases. And for those 15 cases, they use that to establish a IHC marker cutoff, and then use that cutoff to apply for their national registry of 478 cases. But those include cases with TMAs. There's a mixture of different studies there. They look at the expression of other therapeutic targets, and they also, in a different small cohort, they compare 19 matched primary versus metastatic samples to see if the subclassified change. The RNA sequencing data were from the previous study, but they used the IHC in the current study. So let's go to the result part. So first is, as I say, they pick 15 patients. They have the mRNA sequencing data from the previous study. They apply those IHCs on those 15 cases, which five each from A1, A2, and B. So that's why we see like five cases each. In here, they first want to show the A1, A2, and B, what's their immuno profile? What the classification is, first is OTP expression or not. If OTP is positive, it's A1 or A2. If OTP is negative, it's B. And then within A1 or A2, depends on ACL1 expression. There's expression of ACL1, that's A1. There's no ACL1 expression, that's A2. So that's pretty much basic how their classification is. If they look at the HNF1A, it also have higher expression on B, medium expression in A2, and low in A1. So first conclusion, the first result they have is they show the expression profile by RNA. It's similar to their IHC score. So IHC and mRNA have good concordance. And the second thing is they use these five cases and see their IHC profile to set up a threshold that this is the threshold they use based on their 15 cases to set, okay, that's the cutoff they are going to use to classify the further cases. And that's the H score here. Then they use this cutoff to apply on their 478 cases. In that, they compare two things. One is use those PCA, the principal component analysis, because those are like three markers. They kind of use those like down dimension method to plot them into a two-dimension plot from a three dimension parameter into two dimension and let the algorithm to make a cluster and make like three clusters here. That's the color of red, blue, and green into three clusters. They look at all these cases, 400 some cases, use the IHC criteria set up previously to put them in A1, N2, and B, and they show that have a good concordance, like a 94% agreement, using those three markers. If they use five markers, they have even better segregation and less overlapping. Further on, they use those heat map overview is that they plot everything here of their OTP, ACO1, HNF1A, S100, and TTF1 IHC data and compare to other histology data and clinical data to do
Angelo,
any comparison.
we lost your screen, or I did. I can't see if you're pointing at something, all we can see is you.
Oh, I can see the screen.
Me
Yeah,
too.
me too.
This is so weird. Okay, go ahead. I
Okay.
don't know.
All right. So sorry, Henry, I will keep going. All right. So that's the heat map. They try to plot everything together. It's a little bit busy to see, like, there's not super good segregation. Besides, they use the IHC and their subgrouping. So some key findings they say. One is the A1 group, they see there's enriched for female, older age, and peripheral. A2 is for younger, endobronchial, those features. And B is for male, high recurrent, and atypical carcinoid. So I feel a little bit like all over the place. There's like some correlation with those, but I don't see a super strong prognostic relationship there. They showed the treatment related markers, SSTR2A and DLL3. They found that the A1 group have much less expression of SSTR2A, while they have a higher expression of DLL3 compared to the other two groups. And then using their IHC H-score criteria, only 88% of the case were able to be put into those A1, A2, and B. There's 12% of case they are unclassifiable. So they further say use TTF1 and S100 either high, this TTF1 high and S100 low group, they found they have a high ACO1 and low DLL3 groups. So they feel they are more likely to be classified similar to A1, so they call it A1X. The other group found a similar profile to B, and they call it a BX. So it kind of become like five groups with two groups similar to previously groups. I think that's probably the most key figure in the paper is to show the of survival rate and overall survival rate and recurrence free survival rate to see the prognosis. We can see the A1 group is the blue, it's pretty good survival. A2, it's red here, is probably even better survival. B group, probably in the middle. A1X and BX are low down here. That's similar in the recurrence free and the overall survival. and then to the they put the statistics here. So I think from here we can see that A1X and BX are much worse, while others are A1 and A2 are better, B in the middle. In their conclusion, they say A1, there's more dipneic they found in A1 group, and the subgroup does not change between primary and metastatic disease. They claim the unclassified cases are part of those so-called supracarcinoid, which have more aggressive course and reflect by their poor survival. So their conclusion is using those three IHC panel to subclassify them to show a distinct clinical phenotype and the treatment implication. In some cases, those two markers are helpful. What I personally argue on this paper is that I feel like I think that what the data show is that A1, A2B, which they use their panel to primarily subclassify, they really don't have much prognostic power. Even the B group doesn't have statistical difference between A1 or A2. It's probably worse than OTP. Look at OTP alone that shows in different paper and last month's paper. It seems like those unclassifiable cases are the worst. So, I mean, their whole idea of subclassify them becomes an interesting result because those unclassifiable are actually the worst. It's like classifiable, unclassifiable is the prognostic difference, not the subgrouping. And like the paper last month had to go over about like CD44 OTP and KIC7 are much powerful in terms of prognostic. So I really don't know how much this subgrouping actually have much of a prognostic difference. And for the treatment, it looks like the A1 group have some treatment difference, but in why not just stain those SSTR2A and DLL3, but have to use the other three markers as a surrogate. So, and that's my arguments for the paper and open for discussion.
Thank you, Yingjun. Well, certainly interesting paper. And I was thinking the same as you, that there is even another paper in your review today about OTP and how it is useful for prognostication. And did they actually do some multivariate analysis, just comparing whether OTP alone is actually better than all the other markers, which we may or may not have anyway in our labs?
Let me see. I don't think I. Let me think. I think they do analysis on like individual markers like OTP and SCO1, and they do find like OTP have much. They have adjust p value in one of the table one. They show that OTP itself have significant difference. But I think
Interesting.
that's only
Yeah.
for the subgrouping, not
Okay.
for the prognostic. So they don't really analyze any markers for their prognosis. I should say they.
I'm kind
Does
of curious.
anyone do OTP1 routinely?
Yeah, that's what
I'm
I was
just
going to.
asking because one of our clinicians just asked whether we could do OTP for, for prognostication, and they would maybe use it. Yeah, we
We
weren't
haven't,
really
we
entirely
don't have
sure.
that in our labs. I don't think I've been asked to do it, but I don't know if others have been asked to do OTP.
No.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. So I think if we want to look at prognosis, probably OTP plus the markers we talked about like last month are more useful,
Yeah, this
even by
seems
itself.
easier. The other, have anybody been asked? I have been asked a couple of times now to do DLL3 and STTR2, the somatostatin stain on some of the carcinoids, especially one that had recurred, of course, or were metastatic.
Yeah, I think they are probably looking for potential targets, either put
Yeah.
on trial or if they
Right.
run out of options, this is one option they can try.
Is this routine?
Yeah, no, I haven't been asked to do either of those, either the SSTR or DLL3.
It doesn't have to do anything treatment-wise, but I was just curious about, do you look at tumor LET by any chance? So do they just side with the deep neck group? I guess not.
Yeah, I don't think they specifically look for tumor LETs. Okay, thank you for the discussion. I'm moving to the next case, next paper. So the next paper is from an Italian group. So they are looking for mesothelioma. They look at the non-epithelial, which means the biphasic and sarcomatoid. And they look at the patterns, the transitional pattern, and a little bit about the polymorphic pattern. I think they put most focus on those the transitional pattern in the non-epithelioid to see their again the prognostic implication. And plus, they use the reticulin staining to show it's useful for transitional pattern. So that's the idea of this paper. So the background is in the current WHO, there's introduced those different morphology subtype in both epithelioid and sarcomatoid mesothelioma. And then transition of morphology is one of them that we start to learn how to like recognize them and report them. The pattern is characterized by the elongated to well-rounded cell from the epithelioid phenotype to the sarcomatoid morphology. So while there's a definition here that the biologically is like those cells are transitioned from epithelioid to sarcomatoid characteristic, but they also show a challenging for pathologists because it's hard to like classify, say, hey, this is spindle cell, this is epithelioid, this is transition, or how where's the cutoff, where's the line in between? So there's some challenges in recognize or percentage this pattern. So their aim is to come to look at the transitional phenotype and then see if they correlate with outcomes. And that's their main idea. They look back in their database to find 132 pura mesothelioma, and then in those in the non 132 non-epithelioid, including 87 biphasic and 45 sarcomatoid. And in the sarcomatoid morphology, each of them they put them into usual pleomorphic and transitional patterns based on the WHO. And then this is the definition of sarcomatoid pleomorphic and transitional. They use reticulin stain in all the the histotypes. So that's the figures they try to they want to show what they mean by the transitional. So first, it's the polymorphic pattern, which we can see on H&E a lot of those like giant cells in the polymorphic subtype. And this is the transitional subtype that comes from like, that have cells that are kind of in between the epithelioid and the epithelioid and the spindle cell morphology. They use reticulin and then say, this is the area of epithelioid morphology. This is the area of spindle cell or the usual sarcomatoid pattern. And this is the transitional pattern. Show those the extracellular matrix highlighted by the reticulin stain is in between the epithelioid and the spindle cell. They also do different IgG markers to look at those different cases. The morphology patterns are called based on the our current biphasic sarcomatoid histotype. They also count the mitotic count and look at the necrosis. Again, the sarcomatoid pattern are those three patterns. The epithelial pattern, they only do the solid versus non-solid rather than other more detailed patterns for those biphasic cases. And they also look at the survival data. The first result is that they found that in those cases, how is the prevalence of a transitional patterns observed? In the 132, all the mesotheliomas they have at the end of this their study, they show about probably like a quarter of them have transitional pattern. In the biphasic, it's probably also like about a quarter of them have transitional phenotype, transitional pattern. In the sarcomatoid mesothelioma, a little lower percentage of them have transitional pattern, which is not out of expectation because biphasic does have some epithelioid and some sarcomatoid component. They also look at the polymorphic morphology, and then found that in probably like 15% of the cases have polymorphic patterns, a little bit lower than transitional pattern. They say the reticulin stain is helpful because this is the epithelioid pattern. Those reticulin show limited extracellular matrix. This is the transitional pattern, which show those in between cells, and then they get moderate amount of extracellular matrix. This is the polymorphic patterns, which is the giant cell patterns, and this is the sarcomatoid pattern, or the usual spindle cell pattern, which a lot of the extracellular matrix. So they want to show the reticulin stain is really helpful in distinguish different patterns. They also look at the survival. So this is where I argue a little bit on, is that they say there's no significant difference observed between transitional and polymorphic group. If we look at the plot, you can see those have usual pattern, usual predominant patterns. Their survival curve is the blue line. The transitional, it's here, it's kind of pretty much overlap with the usual, while the polymorphic patterns show a worse survival based on look at the curve. So they say if they compare polymorphic versus transitional, there's no significant difference. If that's the case, I think like all three doesn't have much difference. However, they say if they compare all three together, use the analysis, if you look at all three, they have like highly significant difference, which I kind of don't really believe because first, the p value is just like slightly lower than 0.05, and the plot doesn't show like huge difference among those three. So I really don't agree with the highly significant difference as they stated. And then they use other analysis. They show the multilinear analysis. They found that chemotherapy have it's a re patient received chemotherapy is associated with better survival. Those cases with more epithelioid morphology in those biphasic phenotypes, they have better survival, which is not out of expectation. And then higher Ki-67 is worse prognosis. So that's when they analyze things, they found those three are the predictors for survival. As for the diagnostic of transitional pattern, the intra-observer reproducibility was not really high initially, but with reticulin stain, the K-value improved to about like modest agreement. So, which is still not a lot, which is not a great agreement either for the transitional pattern. In their discussion, they say, well, in previous papers, there are several papers show that the transitional pattern is associated with unfavorable prognosis. But in their study, they don't really show that. So they say those are maybe context dependent if they're really related to survival. The lack of consensus for identified transitional pattern, they say the reticulin can help increase the agreement, and they also say maybe AI will be doing better job than human in their discussion. They also found that retained BEP1 is more common in transitional and polymorphic mesotheliomas. Their conclusion is the presence of transitional pattern in the sarcomatoid mesothelioma emerge as a pivotal pursuit for the classification and for patient management. And you can see my argument is, again, I don't really see the data convincingly show that the transitional pattern does have any compelling prognosis relevance compared to polymorphic, because the data show that polymorphic have like worse prognosis and transition doesn't really have so. And an open discussion for everyone is that do you use reticulin or keratin to differentiate epithelioid versus sarcomatoid, or to recognize and percentage the transitional patterns, and open to discussion.
I certainly don't use either of these stains to differentiate between epithelioid or transitional patterns, and most of the biopsies we see are small as well, so I don't know about the relevance.
I have to admit, I used reticulin make sure it's really transitional and not epithelioid. Seems helpful, but yeah.
Yeah, I use it occasionally too. I think that, if we go back to the defining characteristics of transitional, I think the point is not so much that it's different from other sarcomatous, it's that it behaves like a sarcomatous. So I used to show these cases to Colby, and he'd go, "Well, this is epithelial." I go, "No, it's sarcomatous." And then those are the ones that it turns out are the trend, we're now calling transitional. But I think, if it helps, I think as long as you're going to put it in the sarcomatous, that's good. But if you wanted to call it epithelial, I think that's where maybe the reticulin will help. I don't really use it either. I use it to photograph. I have a great case sitting that I want to like snap an image of to show the helpfulness of the reticulin if you're having trouble. But if you're leaning towards calling it sarcomatous anyway, I think that's fine. That's the main point. And I think, their survival curves, I think you're writing, Chun, are not very impressive.
Yichun, I have a question. Did they, we published the paper, the KI in epithelioid middle setting is a very good predictor, just at least not any worse than grading system. And for same token, did you, I mean, I didn't read the paper closely, but did you look at the performance of a KI over those subtyping of the even biphasic, sarcomatoid, transitional, polymorphic, and all different subtypes? No?
Yeah, in their table, I think they look at KI and then show they have prognostic difference. The prognostic is like 0.06, in terms of, sorry, KI. No, KI the it's 0.01, in terms of related to prognosis, but they didn't compare the KI versus the subtype the pattern.
I see. That would be interesting to see. The one day you don't have to worry about what the subtype is and just do the KI and go with it,
I know what you say. Yeah, it's kind of key. I have more predictive to the overall the prognosis, but not really related to the patterns. Okay, thank you everyone. So we're going to move to the third paper. The third paper, I think I will just spend a very short time about it. So this is using INSM-1 to stain the primary thymic neuroendocrine neoplasms. So the idea is that INSM-1 is a neuroendocrine marker that we use it for like lung neuroendocrine tumors. But the group from MGH say they want to look at this marker, how it perform in the primary thymic neuroendocrine neoplasm, which not a lot of data on. They just want to see how they perform in this group. So quickly, INSM-1 is a pretty good sensitive and reliable markers in neuroendocrine markers in different organs, but not much study on the primary thymic neuroendocrine tumor. So that's why they want to establish some data there. And the aim is to stain those a whole spectrum from well-differentiated like kind of a thymic carcinoid to atypical carcinoid, and the poorly differentiated neuroendocrine tumors of the thymus to see the INSM-1 staining pattern. They identified 27 cases to and then do the perform the stain. They also have a TMA, they have 64 thymoma case as a control. Their intensity classified as 1 plus, 2 plus, 3 plus by the intensity from weak to strong. That's the figure they show. That's the 3 plus, that's the 2 plus, that's the 1 plus for the INSM-1 staining. The result shows that 26 out of 27 tumors among all of them have nuclear positivity of INSM-1. 18 of them have strong, 3 of them have moderate, 5 of them have weak nuclear staining. The overall percentage of tumor cells that are positive for INSM-1 is about 76%. Only one case it's negative, it's a small cell carcinoma. All the tumor they are positive for senobitol ficin, like 27 cases, 26 cases of them are positive for chromogranin to compare. The only case they are negative, which is for INSM-1, which is small cell, which is also negative for chromogranin, but show a really focal weak positive for senobitoxin. And then that's the other case of the small cell that have positive, and it's a really necrotic specimen, but the cells are still positive for INSM-1 for the few viable tumor cells. So the author shows that INSM-1 can help in those settings with the very necrotic tumor. The result also look at different subgroup of those neuroendocrine tumors. The three typical carcinoid, they show really good, all have two of them have strong 3+ INSM-1 staining. One case have 2+ in 60% of the cells. The atypical carcinoid have lower expression. They say overall still have good expression, but only about 11 out of 18 have strong positive stainings, while other 7 cases have weaker stainings. Higher grade tumors, large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas, like 3 out of the 4 have 3+ in 90%, with one case have 3+ in only about 20%. For the two small cell, one of them have a strong diffuse positive INSM-1, and the other one is negative due to limited tissue. In comparison, the thymoma case on the TMA, they show about like 8% of the case can also have INSM-1 staining, including different type. So their discussion is that they say INSM-1 can be a useful markers in the thymic neuroendocrine markers because they show pretty good sensitivity in picking up those tumors. However, there are some other entities may also show INSM-1 positivities or neuroendocrine morphology. But so what they claim is that INSM-1 could be a good sensitive marker for thymic neuroendocrine tumors, but they are not entirely specific due to few thymomas can be positive and other rare entities. And this is open for discussion.
Did they compare the three different markers? Like which one was more sensitive or specific among Synapto, Chromo, and INSM-1? You said it, I maybe missed it. Sorry.
Yeah, so they didn't specifically say about the sensitivity, but they say chromo is all positive, synapto is all positive, chromo and INSM-1 is 26 out of 27. That's the sensitivity. So it's like
So
all pretty good.
they're all pretty good. Okay.
Okay, due to time limit, I'm going to move to the last one. So this one is to look at the airway inflammation in post-transplant cystic fibrosis patients and to see if features in the airway inflammation correlate to clade. They only look at the cystic fibrosis patient that receive transplant. So the background is that those CF patients, because their airway are colonized with microbial flora. So after transplantations, they are those like colonized the flora can still move to the lung and cause confusions or adverse effect. And in those patients, it's challenging to tell between the infection because the colonized the flora, they move to the lung, or rejection in that settings, it's very difficult to distinguish. So they and in other papers show that eels sometimes often found to associate with airway inflammation. It can be associated with rejection and then linked to adverse allograft outcomes. So their aim is to see, they speculated that eels or neutrophils in the biopsy are associated with a high risk clay. So they compare those histology findings and the clinical outcome. Both the histology findings, the pathology diagnosis, and the clinical outcomes. The method is they look at their transplant data. They found 40 cases are the CF patients who received lung transplant. Some are earlier before 2014, and some are later because they have different preparations. They look at the pathology data, other features, and clinical outcomes. In 8 years of follow-up, if there's a boss or death, that's one outcome, and negative for those, it's a different outcome as they are primarily a prognostic difference. They look at the presence of EOS in any biopsy and then see if it is rare, few, moderate, or extensive, depends on how many of the EOS they see in the biopsy. And they classify it as the eosinophil rich or neutrophil rich if the presence of EOS or neutrophils falls to at least moderate or extensive. This is the only histology paper they show in the paper, and then show that's a regular that's the explant of the patients, and those are the representative picture of active perivascular rejection with venulitis. This one is moderate A2 rejection. This one is B1R. This one is the obliterate. And this one is the allograft vasculopathy with a lot of fibrin exudates. If they look at their result, is they compare the outcomes like boss or no boss, and then boss or death, they found that like earlier patients do worse and the later patients do better nowadays. Bacterial infection is associated with outcome. Fungal infection is associated with outcome. B score, A score, and EOS in large airways all related to outcome. So that's the findings they found, that those factors are significant related to outcome. And then they look at those like 2x2 comparison. They found that EOS and BOS are highly correlated. Neutrophils and BOS, it's highly correlated. A score it's an EBOS are highly correlated. In other comparison, they found those fungal infections. This row is the fun, this column is the called fungal infection. It's highly associated with bacterial infection, B score and A score. So those three things are highly correlated to each other. And they also plot that the EOS in large airway and the BOS-free survival have like pretty good difference in the presence or absence of EOS in large airway. So field discussion is that they found the high strong correlation with airway EOS versus ACR, but not much with B score. So with A score, but not B score. The mechanism of EOS, it's not entirely clear, but it could be show up in a fungal infection, rejection, or drug-induced injury. And they do not really count the BAL EOS. They look at the biopsy EOS, but not counted the BAL EOS. As they say, the data is not consistently available in their data. So the conclusion is that the EOS in the transplant, especially in the large airway, have higher risk to develop a BOS and or graft failure. Well, my argument is that the EOS could be used, but the EOS doesn't still like their initial question is that does the EOS can help us tell an infection versus rejection? But the EOS looks like it's a higher association with infection and rejection, so it doesn't really help us in terms of define that to guide our clinical colleagues to which lung to go. go. And I see there's also a lot of confounding because the EOS and big neutral fields and A and B, they are all related to each other. So I'm not exactly sure this association is only EOS dependent, or it's just a confounding with everything else. And this is open for discussion. And the other thing interesting is the EOS in a small airway doesn't really show prognostic difference, but it's the EOS in large airways that show the difference, which is also kind of surprise, or I don't exactly know what does they implicate, because I think the what those we look at the A and B are more related to the small airways, and the B is more to the small airway rather than the large airway. But just a lot of confounding here, like bacteria, fungus, A and B, and EOS in large airway, and kind of all mixed together, hard to tease them out. That's what
That's what I
I
was
feel.
wondering, actually. So, in the larger airways, we usually don't regard them as a rejection, right? Although airway inflammation is a little kind of a not clear anyway, but especially large airway, the inflammation, we suspect that's probably not rejection, but something else.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like there are a lot of confounding factors. I don't think, I feel like it's hard to see like EOs in isolation, given that there's also some strong association with, infections, and that is probably more of a like impactful factor than like the presence of EOs is the presence of, fungal or bacterial infections.
Yeah, thank you. We are almost out of time. So one last slide is that, so the I feel like there's other articles that were three. One is the one of the name is the review article in histopathology talking about reporting features in lung cancer. It's kind of how we feel the CAP the CAP synoptic. There's a lot of like good guidance of how we feel those CAP synoptics. There's an interesting case that Christine have about the picomatosis in AJSP. And that's the what Anya mentioned about like OTP itself is related better to outcomes in a pulmonary carcinoid. And that's all. Sorry for the technical difficulty, but thank you everyone for coming to the Journal Club.
Thank you.
Thank
Thank
you
you
so
so much.
much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
All right.
you.
Have a nice day, everyone.